Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
So it's a special Wednesday night rugby this evening. Delighted to say we have Rory Best in studio to reflect on a very long and eventful career. You're very welcome.
Thanks, Joe.
You have had, what, about 2 months of eating what you want, drinking what you want, lying around, doing nothing. How is retirement thus far?
I think with my body type, I need to be a little bit careful what I eat. I think the first couple of weeks you have, you kind of go, this is brilliant. You know, I've got no strict diets, you know, no one to chase me up. No people telling me I have a DEXA scan next month that I really need to panic about. And you kind of let yourself go a little bit. And then very quickly, you kind of, because obviously, you know, when you're time off in the summer and you go into pre-season, you know how difficult it can be to shift unwanted weight when you put it on. So I've been trying to do a little bit of training. Like, ultimately, that is the bit that I did enjoy as well. The matches are the big bit, but I did enjoy the training. So it's nice to go in and do a little bit and actually do what you want and not to be told what to do.
And will you shrink now? Will you lose a load of weight?
I might shrink in the areas that I don't necessarily want to shrink in and expand in the areas maybe around the waist that you don't particularly want to expand in. But do you know what? I'm not really sure what's going to happen, because like, I naturally would be quite heavy if I don't look after myself. But also, the flip side of that, in the last few years, I've wanted to maybe be a kilo or two heavier and sort of have struggled to maybe get to there at times.
Okay. Well, we'll reflect on the rugby, and there is much to reflect on. There's an issue which really you haven't talked about in too much depth, and maybe in an environment like this, as opposed to down a phone line or in a press conference, it might be more appropriate to do that. So we might start with it. So I'm not shoehorning this in at the very end of the interview, because I don't want to be rushed. It's too sensitive and too complicated for that. I'm talking obviously about the Belfast trial, your appearance at it. A broad point firstly to make, there were really no winners out of this whole saga. And you, while not being the primary loser, certainly fall into that category. This has, I'm sure you would agree, followed you around, hung over you. It's something you have been associated with. You feel that, you acknowledge that.
Okay, yeah, I think it's hard not to acknowledge that. And I think your first point is, you know, really nobody won out of it. It was, and like, I'm far from a victim in this, you know, compared to the other five people that were directly involved in it. You know, like, I suppose ultimately for me, the toughest thing to take was some of the social media stuff. But, you know, you delete Twitter and you can kind of get away from it. Whereas from the other five people that were involved in it, you know, it wasn't that straightforward. They're trying to rebuild their lives now in various shapes and form. And I think that is probably the most important thing for me to emphasise, that, yeah, look, those bits of it, and like, it still follows you a bit now, but not to the extent that the other five are, you know, I'm sure it's following them or that they think about.
In Joe Schmidt's book recently, he said, so you went on the Wednesday and you came back on the Wednesday evening. This was the Saturday drop goal game in Paris that week. He said somewhere between Wednesday and Friday, you had reached a point where you were certainly willing to give up the captaincy. Why? What had you done wrong?
Do you know, I think the big thing is, from a captaincy point of view, I think there's enough pressure on a team around the rugby, and, you know, people thinking you should play this way, you know, the performance, what people are expecting or what people perceive to be the French game or whatever game it is, and how you should do in that. And that is pressure. And I think from a captain, and, you know, obviously the coach and the captain coach and all of that, part of your job is to protect the team a little bit. You know, shelter, you know, you're out in front, it's up to you to take that. And I felt that with what had happened on the Wednesday, it had actually done the opposite. I had brought more pressure, more external pressure on the team, when the rugby pressure is enough to try to handle, and you can shield a bit from that, then I was bringing more pressure. And that is, it was sort of contrary to the role that I saw myself doing as captain. And that's why I kind of said that I'm not doing the team any favours by being captain.
How quickly did you realise on the Wednesday or the Thursday how big this had become?
I think you probably realise quite quickly, and social media is, you know, the great thing about it is how quickly you get your news. You know, everything happens. As soon as something happens, you get immediate an update or whatever it is. And, you know, you'll also get, from a personal point of view, you get immediate feedback, and very quickly it got the, I suppose, the social media backlash, for want of a better expression, on Wednesday evening when I got down into camp.
Did you go and talk to Joe straight away?
No, you see, Wednesday evening's a bit it's a strange one because you kind of come in early and I try to do a little bit of prep on my own, go to the computers, go to the room, get a few of the plays written down, get a bit of physio and massage, and then we have a walkthrough, which is all about the team. And
I'd say your head was elsewhere during a lot of that.
It was. You know, I think it's not nice when you read some of the stuff on social media. But again, like, immediately the thought just goes to the pressure, the unnecessary pressure from a rugby point of view, and going into the first game of a championship that there's enough pressure on.
Mm. So to be clear here, you were listed as a potential character witness, which is something that happens in trials up north and doesn't happen down here in the Republic. We're not as familiar with it. So presumably Paddy Jackson came to you and asked you to be a character witness.
Yeah, Paddy asked me, and like, as a character witness, all you're really doing is testifying to the character, the person you know. You know, you're not involved in anything that, and in any case of what the actual accusations are. It's just to say that I know this guy on a personal and professional, or both, or whichever it is, level, and this is what I deem his character to be whenever he's with me. And I think as someone that I get quite friendly with from in an Ulster point of view, and as a teammate, whenever he asked me to do it, you know, I kind of felt that, like, I think when a friend is in need and he asks you to sort of do something that, you know, if you get to a stage of either sentencing or not sentencing, that might be able to help him. You know, I think that it's really hard to turn your back on a friend, no matter what your view on the ins and outs of it is. And that was ultimately it. You know, I knew as a captain that I was somebody that he looked up to, and he was somebody that, as a player and a person that I spent time with around the team environment, that I got on very well with.
Did you hesitate when he asked? Did you deliberate for a number of days? Did you take advice?
No, I didn't, because, like I say, ultimately when a friend needs something, and like I say, you emphasise that, like what they were accused of, you know, when you're doing a character witness, that is, you have to just testify to what your impression of their character is from spending time with them.
Mm. So then it was day two when you went, because you were off training that day. Wednesday is your day off. And a certain confluence of events probably added to the charged nature of the atmosphere generally and to the reaction around you. Because on day one, two things in particular happened which obviously made headlines. One, certain details of the WhatsApp messages were widely reported on, and as you can imagine, everybody took a dim view of them. And then secondly, there was a text from the complainant in the case sent the morning after the alleged incident, where she had said one of her concerns about going to authorities was to go up against Ulster Inc. in effect. Not a direct quote, but that was what she had said. So given that, the appearance of the Irish and Ulster rugby captain alongside another teammate certainly caught people's eye, to say the least. So were you aware of that on day one? Had you seen that on day one? Did that give you extra pause for thought?
I think probably the first thing is to say that the stuff around the text messages, you know, like, as a, I suppose, as a normal citizen, if you like, you know, like, you don't approve of that at all. You don't agree with any of that. And like I said, from the character witness point of view, it was about testifying his character. So under no circumstance did I find anything in that WhatsApp group that was anything less than, you know, grossly wrong. Mm. And I think as well, it needs to be said that as a rugby player, you have a role, you know, you are a role model and you have a responsibility to conduct yourself that way. I think on the second thing, I think ultimately you're in a bit of a bubble, and look, it's not an excuse, and it can be misstrewn whatever way it wants, but like, you're in a bit of a bubble, and there is no way that I would ever have went to that court case knowing. I didn't go there as the Irish captain. I went there as a friend who was just sort of seeing whether I definitely still wanted to be a character witness. And I think that the ramifications, like, you are in a bubble.
Except the friend point, but equally, the good and the bad, you are also just Rory Best rugby captain. You know, if you do ambassadorial work, if you do commercial work, part of your billing is, I am Rory Best, the Ireland captain. Therefore, you know, I am a brand in itself, and I carry a weight, and I have no doubt that is why the defence team thought you might be a good character witness. So whilst it's an extra burden to be captain on top of private citizen, you have to accept. You can't just stroll into court and disassociate that.
I obviously get that now in hindsight. And look, I'll be the first to admit that I was unbelievably naive to think that that isn't the way it would be brought across. But I can assure you, Joe, that that was never of my intention. And, you know, I look back now in hindsight and I didn't think at the time because, you know, look, ultimately I'm a trusting person. And I look back now and I do think that I was used. I didn't ever think that it would be that case, but I have no doubt, like you said yourself, that it suited the prosecution to have me there.
The defence, to
have me there because of, and I think that I became a pawn in it, and that is the bit that, like,
yeah,
I think now in hindsight, you know, looking at that, you know, it was bad advice for me to be there. And look, I was, like I say, naive enough to think that I could go there as a friend. And look, I accept exactly what you're saying. And like, ultimately, you know, you go to all these roles as the captain, and I don't know why I thought this would be different, but look, ultimately I did. And that is one of the things that I'm very sorry for, because it was never, ever my intention to cause any more distress on what was a very, very difficult day for that poor girl anyway.
And when you say I was naive and I was in a bubble, do you mean to say that you hadn't followed day one, you hadn't seen her text the next morning? Like, surely, really, you must have been aware.
Like, of course you were aware, but...
And did that not make you think, she's literally said, part of the issue here for me is going up against Ulster Inc., whatever that means. I think we sort of know what she means. Did part of you not think, we need to have a second thought about our plan tomorrow here, on that basis?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, again, with the benefit of hindsight, you know, you would have taken a second and done that. But I think it was kind of at a point where, you know, I felt that I had said to Paddy I would be a character witness, and I said I would be there, someone to talk to if you needed to talk to. And I kind of felt that, and this is all in hindsight, I don't think that there's no way that Paddy would have ever have used something like that. But I do think that, like I say, I do think that I was used, and that is the bit that I'm most sorry for and I regret the most.
Because you said after the game in Paris that as a character witness, it was important I got both sides of the story. You said that was the legal advice from senior counsel. That was from Jackson's defence team, was it?
It was, yeah.
Okay. So as you said, as a character witness, you're not there to be an expert on the case. You're not there to judge anything. And also, like, did it not occur to you, okay, to get both sides, fine, this is like a 42-day case. What can I get in one day?
Yeah, I think that, like I say, I was just there that they advised me, and like, I know now and in hindsight that was wrong and that I shouldn't have been there. But I think...
Did you take independent legal advice around that time?
No, I didn't. And again, that was more mistakes, because I think when you're a reasonably trusting person, you kind of think that, oh, look, well, if they're saying this, then, you know, it must be for my benefit. When, look, it turned out it wasn't, and if anything, it was not... I suppose my benefit or detriment was irrelevant in it, but it just turned it into a circus, and it put a lot more pressure on something that was very sensitive. And like I said before, I think that is the thing that I definitely regret the most, that, you know, to turn it into, to, I suppose, turn up the magnifying glass on it, on like that, is just something that, I suppose you say you live and learn, but this was a big thing that you had to live and learn for.
Because from a defence point of view, certainly your presence in front of the jury, crucially, in front of everybody, a big statement, in many respects, your presence alone on that day is every bit as effective as being a character witness and taking to the stand and testifying. So in a sense, it was job done. Rory Best, stamp of approval.
And that, like I say, is the thing that I regret the most, is that, and, you know, there's no... Under no circumstances did I go there. I know people are going to listen and go, how could he not? This is foolish. But, like, I don't want to keep saying you're in a bubble, because, that's not an excuse. And, you know, with all the sort of people that have their opinions, and people have some very extreme opinions, and, you know, that is the bit that, no matter what people say to me, that I know in myself that I was probably used a little bit. And again, like not by Paddy, but by his team. And, like, ultimately, that is a bit that I have to sort of live with, in that I caused undue stress to people. And like, I would like to think that one of the reasons I want to step down as captain is because I, you know, from a humane point of view, you're putting pressure on people, and that is not something that I would ever want to do.
So the charge, for instance, that in some respects, and it is only people trying to speculate, because I certainly haven't spoken to the complainant, I don't know, but the charge might be that, well, it was an extra layer of intimidation. What's your response to that?
it was never my intention. And like I say, I went there to sort of, you know, to as much as anything, just to, I suppose I obviously went there under advice and, you know, I sort of thought that it was right to hear, you know, the reasoning at the time sort of felt reasonable to me to, you know, to hear, to sort of get and to get a feel for what was going on and to hear, like to make sure that I still could testify as his character. And like ultimately the thing that, that you tell yourself is that, you know, what I'm commenting on is him as a person that I know. And it's not, it definitely wouldn't be commenting on the charges. It definitely wouldn't be commenting on the text messages or the WhatsApp messages because, you know, I would, like we said earlier, I would hold a very dim view of those.
And did the WhatsApp messages give you cause for second thought about testifying?
I think from a, like I said, from a member of society point of view, you know, they're not good reading, but, you know, I think ultimately that's not the Paddy I knew. So like, that's all I could do was testify to his character.
It is important to say, very important to say in the interest of balance here, that you went on the Wednesday, the match was on the weekend. Obviously, it was a furore to say the least. On the Monday, Judge Patricia Smith did turn to the jury and she did say, the only reason he, being Rory Best, the only reason he was in court was because he was directed to be here by senior counsel. So that was at least said to the jury.
Yeah, it was. And like I say, while I was directed, you know, ultimately, you know, you should have, well, I should have at least got independent advice. I think that's probably the mistake. Yeah. And I'd hold my hands up and say I made that. And I think why I struggle to talk about it so much is because, like, obviously I don't like talking about it because I know I made that mistake and put pressure on people. But ultimately, you know, there are five people. I don't want people to think that I want people to feel sorry for me because it was my mistake. But also, in terms of there are five people that are trying to rebuild their life that have been through a lot more than me. You know, I said at the start, I deleted Twitter and a lot of that noise went away. You can't fully get away, but a lot of that noise went away, whereas deleting social media for these five young people is not going to do it. And that's why, like, I felt that it needed to be talked about, because obviously Joe, and like Joe very, like, he didn't say very much about his book, but it came up, and that's why it's raised its head again. And but ultimately, I think it's important that we let these young people try to get on with rebuilding their life. And, you know, it's of no consequence to me to bring it up for whatever reason.
In the end then, finally, you didn't appear as a character witness. Why not?
I think for those reasons that because it turned into something that they didn't want, you know, it turned into about rugby and about the pressure being applied from the rugby fraternity, and they said that, you know, it kind of took the decision out of my hands, which was good from my point of view, because I'd seen what it had become, and they said it was of no benefit to have that again.
Yeah. And if they hadn't taken it out of your hands, where was your head? What would you have done?
I don't think you could be in a position to answer that, because no matter what you say, you're going to upset people. And to be honest, at that stage, I was trying to get my head around being captain of Ireland and to try to make sure that it wasn't about, it was about rugby. So look, to be honest, it was the case was going on so long, definitely not dragging on. It was, you know, it had to run its course with its merits. But, you know, at that stage, I hadn't really given it any thought. And then they actually came to me before I'd even given it a proper thought. So I wouldn't want to answer that.
It's a difficult dilemma. Thankfully, I haven't been in it. But being asked to be a character witness is not an easy decision. And I think people understand that as well.
Yeah, I'd like to think that while maybe people don't, like, people have very strong opinions about me going, I'd like to think that the character witness bit, you know, to testify to somebody's character that you know, is very different to actually aligning yourself with the charges or the text messages. And I'd like to think that people could take those in isolation, but, you know, some people will and some people won't. But I can assure you that nobody feels worse about that, about what happened off the back of that day than I did. Okay.
And the last one, is one of the reasons maybe you didn't say it to Schmidt or say it to the IRFU that we're going, because you might have sensed they might have said, there's no chance you're going near that?
No, I think it's
a big thing to keep quiet, it would strike me.
Yeah, it was just sort of, do you know what, it was just a day off and you go off and people do what they want. And again, in hindsight, you know, you wished you had said something, because that could have been the independent, might have been independent legal advice, but it would have been independent advice. Because, like I say, when you're sort of so close to it, you sometimes stop and you don't stop. And that's what I didn't do. And that's, like I say, it's a regret of mine.
Look, it's going to come up in an environment like this, away from conversations like this, away from social media. Are you, hard to pick the right words, I was going to say almost at peace with yourself, or have you parked it?
Look, I think that that's one of the reasons for doing this, is because, you know, I don't want to keep bringing it up, because it definitely doesn't benefit the five people involved. And like, ultimately, that is where it should be now, to allow them to get on with it, and me standing here talking about it and going around other places and talking. And that's why, like, part of the reason I have no interest in talking it, because it's not fair on them.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to say before we move on?
No. Look, I think it's covered, and like ultimately, there are certain regrets I have around it, and that sort of, and I think that there's the feeling that people saw me in a bad light, which, you know, is something that I sort of prided myself on. That, you know, I'd like to think that I'm a reasonably good guy.
Okay. We will, I think, draw breath and take a break. It's hard to segue straight into a rugby discussion now. So we're back in a couple of minutes. Okay, Rory Best is still with us as part of this interview to reflect on the career. So we've obviously spent quite a bit of time on one specific part of the career. Can I take you back to County Armagh? Because I was thinking about this, and I never really heard you talk about it too much. I make it you were kind of 16, 17, around the time of the Good Friday Agreement.
Uh-huh.
So certainly your childhood, and then a reasonable chunk of your adolescence, is dealing with, we're seeing atrocities, we're seeing ceasefires, then they come, break down, and then they come good again. To what extent, for you, did the Troubles loom large? Was it a big part of your daily, weekly existence?
Do you know what? It wasn't really. You know, I think that, like, obviously I was born in the early 80s, you know, which wasn't a great time, but with time we got to, like, when you're at an age where you remember stuff. And look, I grew up in a little village, Points Pass, like you say, right in the County Armagh, down border, and it was very much a mixed village. And like, we were really lucky. We only ever had one flashpoint in the village, when there was a gunman burst into the local pub and shot dead two best friends, a Protestant and a Catholic. And it was, that was the time when it really kind of hit home on you, because like, I was really lucky with my family. You know, they did a lot to shelter us from it. And, you know, you'd obviously hear it all in the news and bits and pieces, but in terms of being directly impacted, like, I was really lucky. I loved the village that I grew up in. You know, we had great fun. Even my dad brought rugby to the primary school, because we didn't have there wasn't really many sports, but it was a small primary school, 70 pupils we had. But he then, when we brought it in, sort of once he got it established a year or two, then what we did was we did a combined, because it was our school, Points Pass, and then sort of halfway up the hill was the St Joseph's School. It's now St John's, but it was St Joseph's then. And so we did a combined rugby team, just to give us numbers. And like, ultimately, it wasn't about anything other than, you know, trying to give us the best possible chance of being good at a sport.
We have Trevor Ringland on the show on Sunday. We recorded the interview already, and, you know, he came in and he was talking yesterday about how, you know, he's an Ulster man, he's an Irishman, he's a European, he's a Leeds United fan. At Croke Park for the England game, he said he sang all three anthems and meant them all. Your sense of identity as Irish captain?
Yeah, I think that as Irish captain, it comes down to one simple thing. My love and my ambition has always been to play for Ireland. You know, going as a young kid to watch Ulster games, being brought to do we have to say the old Lansdowne Road now?
Yeah.
You know, being brought down to there to watch Ireland, and like obviously whenever, like, very different to the kids now, you know, there wasn't professional rugby when I was young, so it wasn't a dream to play professional rugby, but it was a dream to kind of, a dream that you didn't think was actually achievable, to play for Ulster in Ireland. It seemed so far, you know, so far away from a little village in Points Pass. And like that, like, from a rugby point of view, that, like, that's my identity. I'd like to think that I give as much to the Ulster jersey as I did to the Ireland jersey, and vice versa. And Look, ultimately, I live in Northern Ireland, and you know, when you write on your passport form or whatever it is, I have a British passport. But if you're asking me, would I want to play for any other country in the world, there'd be not a chance. Ireland is the only country that I've ever dreamed of playing for.
I think that was Trevor's point, actually, that you can be Rory Best OBE, British passport, Irish captain, whatever team you support, and
Middlesbrough, unfortunately.
Middlesbrough, my goodness.
Which is worse than Trevor, unfortunately.
So trying to hem someone in to a tight, well, what side are you on? Yeah. Is thankfully something it seems you managed to avoid even from childhood.
Yeah, and like I say, it is so unique to this island to have that, and but it's also such a brilliant thing that, you know, it's not a, like you say, right throughout my childhood, it's not a thing. You know, it was, we were a rugby family, so our weekends were, well, it wasn't, our weekends were Banbridge Rugby Club and then the occasional Inter-Pro touring team. And then when you looked forward to the Six Nations, because those were the, now when I was a bit younger, as much as anything, it was the stop in at the Monaster Boys for a steak on the way home was as much of the draw as the rugby, because like, I did love rugby, but I was young and liked my food.
So you get in at Ulster and quite quickly then you get called into the Irish team, if we skip ahead a few years. At that stage, it's you and Gerry Flannery.
Yeah.
The nature of that rivalry, was that bitter and glaring at each other across the room, or what was that like?
No, because you don't, like, it's very, very rare that you would get that sort of rivalry. Look, ultimately, he's a real competitor. And, you know, I'm probably inward as competitive as anyone there, but I probably don't show it as much. But like, I think that rivalry was one that I know certainly got the best out of me, because I probably was kidding myself a little bit in my early professional career, and he sort of showed me from, you know, he didn't intentionally show me, but from the way he was and the way he trained, he showed me that it actually does matter how you look after yourself away from camp, away from everything. And
he's a diligent pro, to say the least.
He definitely is, yeah. And I learned a lot from him. And look, because I'm competitive, I wasn't happy to go, well, look, he's really good, so I'll just sit behind him. I said, look, I want to get ahead, and if I want to be in a position that if he... So I sort of came in first, and I got my cap first, was meant to start against Romania. Then I got injured, and he came into the bench, or he was on the bench and brought Shane Byrne in ahead of him. And then the Six Nations, I kind of thought that because I'd been due to start against Romania, that I had sort of a right to then, and that was the natural order of things, and I didn't. And to be honest, I sort of looked at it then and went, right, well, if I want to get ahead of this guy, then I'm going to have to learn some things from him. Because, like I said, I was kidding myself in the way you trained hard in the summer, you got yourself in a certain condition, and then just over the season, it kind of just deteriorated a little bit, you know, because you get into games and you kind of think you put your feet up.
Well, I saw you say to Donald Lynch in an interview a while back that at a certain point, you really knuckled down. You gave up drink. You know, Mondays, which might have been, geez, I've got to get through this at training, became, I want to train hard kind of days. What age did you make that adjustment or that change?
Probably around that sort of 07. Right. The end of that first season where Gerry basically leapfrogged me. And that sort of looking at him, and, you know, it was just a case of wanting to get better, you know, and it sort of go... Like, it wasn't enough for me, because I was sort of well established as an Ulster player and an Ulster
starter. Very comfortable
starter.
In Ulster.
And I didn't want to be this player that just sort of was really good at Ulster, and then when I went down to Ireland, and look, it still happens, you know, you hear people moaning, oh, the Ulster players don't get a fair crack of the whip. Well, I've never really experienced that, because when people moan about it, I kind of look and go, well, you know, over the years, what consistency have Ulster shown? It'd be different if you flip the roles now and Ulster were where Leinster are right now and they weren't getting players in the Ireland squad, you'd be going, right, there's something up here. But, you know, we've never been in that position.
No.
And any time we were good, we actually got a decent representation. So it also annoys me a little bit, because I've had to work really hard and change the way I've played to become a regular starter.
So I read you're an excellent scrummager. I'm not totally afraid with the dark arts, so I'll take people's word who know what they're talking about for that. The other big responsibility, obviously, at hooker is the line-out, the darts. Do you have a love-hate relationship with this aspect of the game? Because this comes and goes, and, geez, it's not easy.
It's not, and, yeah, you know what? It's something that I used to love. Because, like, and I you know what? There's bits of it that I still do. Like, I love the practice. I love sort of throwing. And even in a game, there's nothing better than that feeling. It's like, if you like, you know, a golf shot or whatever sport you play, where you just get it perfect and you know, and it's so easy and effortless, and you get those throws in a game and you just know that someone like Pete is going to get it and he's going to pluck at the top of a jump and it's going to look perfect.
There's a certain balletic beauty when it's done well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's a nice feeling.
Yeah.
Right. Tell me when you've thrown your first two and it hasn't gone to plan and you're not sure if it's their fault or your fault, probably a combination of two, and you're standing there 10 metres from the try line, you need to land this one. That's when it gets sticky.
Well, I'd always like to think it's their fault, of course, so you have to sort of tell yourself that.
Yeah.
Like, I think that there's a lot of pressure on it because it's a bit like goal kicking in that it's an isolated moment in time when the stadium and everyone seems to stop and stare right at you. Where's this going to go? The only difference, like I would say to Johnny, is that he's not kicking the goalposts that are sliding up and down the pitch. And that is something that I've learned over my career, that you know, you need to practice it. I used to think that it was enough, like back in the early days, I used to think that it was enough just to throw to the line out in training, that would get you enough reps. And again, with probably a bit with Jerry and a bit with everything else, you kind of go, I need to do more. And then probably by the end of it, I probably became obsessive and probably too obsessive with my throwing. You know, I had to do, you know, I was getting to a stage where I was nearly getting tennis elbow because I was throwing, you know, I was maybe doing every day, like somewhere near 100 extra balls I'd be throwing at least 4 days a week. And, you know, like it's a lot of throws. But you get to that line out 10 metres, like you say, in that scenario, you've just lost two. Like, all you can really do is trust the work you've done, the practice you put in. You know, I do see sports psychologists, so there's all of that to sort of go, right, you've got to trust what you're doing and try to put it in the right spot. And then all you can do is trust the people in your team that they get themselves to that same spot. So that's sort of...
And is there a low point in it all? Like there was a from memory, there was a certainly a Lions warm-up game where it deserted you. And again, that may not have been your fault. You know, I'm not the technician who knows. But is there a point where it really got on top of you ever, or was it generally?
I think that Lions tour was difficult in 13. Right. And do you know what generally happens is, I would think that certainly, if you lose a couple in a row, the first couple, or maybe even all of those, certainly the first couple, probably aren't your fault. But what happens is then you allow it to get on top of you, and then it does start to become your fault because you know, you just know that this is going to be, like I always like to think that the hookers, they get blamed when it goes wrong and the second rows get pat on the back when it goes well. And look, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
But certainly in that Lions tour in 13, and I think probably the biggest thing is you kind of look back and you go, you put all those hours in for what? For nothing. In any profession, if you put in a lot of work and get absolutely no reward for it, it is just soul destroying.
Some lad shouts from the crowd, Jesus, best, would you not practice?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and then the hardest thing, so that was sort of the Lions and that finished, that was probably one of the hardest games was to come back. So that would have been start of July, finished, didn't play for Ulster until maybe the end of September. And that's a long time to be waiting to kind of get another go to show that you're not crap. And the first liner to that game, I'll never forget it, it was Zebra up at the Kingspan. And it was just like, you don't, because you like to practice and be very, and all your psychology, but at that moment you kind of just almost close your eyes and hope, just please let this go right.
You'll forgive me if I don't remember that particular line out.
No,
I can see why it's important to you.
Not many people watch the Zebra ones.
What is the Joe Schmidt effect on you? I know the general theme, what he does with the team at large and the detail and everything else. What does he do for your game?
I think the big thing for me is that he is a real belief, and he puts it across to you that everyone is as important as each other. Like, if you like, for example, when the winger scores in the corner, you know, everyone will go, that winger's class.
Yeah.
Or Johnny might hit him with a pass and everyone will go, Johnny's class, look at that pass, look at the way the winger scored that try. Whereas what a lot of people won't see is that somebody will hit four rucks in a row to make sure that ball's quick to allow this to happen. Yeah. And that's the bit that he sees, and that's the bit where he'll go. And if we're talking about that move, he'll sit at a meeting and go, great finish, world-class pass, but what I want you to look at, and he'll show stuff like that. And for me, like, my game is basically based around hard work. I'd like to think there's a bit of skill in there, but like hard work and like being one of the best exponents in around the breakdown that there is. And when that's not highlighted, if people don't necessarily see the correlation between somebody smashing a rock to get you, and like you're talking about split seconds here, to get you a split second more makes all the difference to the wing. When you don't get that credit, you know, you kind of sometimes feel like you're thumping your head into a brick wall for no credit. And like, it's not about credit. Joe spots it, and Joe puts emphasis on it as well. You know, like even you look at the wide rucks, you know, if a winger gets blast off a ball in the wide ruck, you know, like a lot of coaches would go, oh, he's a winger, we don't expect him to be good at that. Whereas Joe goes, nah, that is unacceptable.
Okay.
And he'll pick someone that won't, that maybe isn't necessarily who the public might pick.
And something I wanted to ask you, you talked there about work rate being a key component of your game. And I presume, you know, look, 37-year-old, there's no place for 37-year-olds in Test rugby, certainly, and there won't be in the future. So you certainly hung on. And maybe in an ideal world, if the World Cup is at the end of 2018 for the whole team, in fact, that would have fallen a bit nicer. Did you feel across 2019, your own form, your own work rate, the numbers you could hit, did that diminish? Were you a frustrated man out there? Did you feel your age, or where were you?
No, I actually felt all right. And I know there was criticism, but that criticism was largely in the press. And I actually felt, especially at the World Cup, I felt that I was playing well. And look, I think probably the biggest thing is potentially, I do think the game's is changing and evolving, and if you look at the breakdown of this Irish squad, it is now about big ball carriers, and that wouldn't have mattered if I was 37, 27 or 17. That is never going to be my game, and I think it's a bit of a worry from that point of view. But yeah, look, there's a bit of and I think the criticism comes whenever a team doesn't win, you pick up on a few people that, you know, you start to question.
Yeah.
When in 18, being 36, age is fine. In 19, we're losing, and all of a sudden age is a factor. And like, I felt, and you know what, if I had ever felt that I was struggling, I would have. And look, let's be honest, Joe's not the sort of person that's going to keep somebody along for the crack.
No, just ask Devon Toner. You know, he can be ruthless for sure. Not many players put their head above the parapet when it came to trying to address what went wrong in 2019. So step forward Rory Best about a month and a half ago or so. I saw you were on Air Sport then about a week or two later. You certainly said you didn't like the headlines, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You felt that what was in the body of the text represented your views, and you stood by them. So to give people a sense of things, I must say, took the criticism, leaving the headlines aside, as fairly pointed criticism of Joe and things he could have done better. Now, I'll get on to other stuff you said about players, but of Joe, the great thing about 2018, we had our own voice, our own mind, we had that freedom at the end of the week to step into the space to lead. In 19, that end of the week space was starting to be filled a bit much with coaches. At the end of the England defeat at Twickenham, we sat down with Joe and we said, we trust you implicitly, we know you'll get tactics right, but on the flip side, you're going to have to trust us that from captain's run onwards, let us build our own way. I think we didn't do enough to fill it. Me as captain, ultimately, I have to take a fair bit of responsibility. Were we just happy to go, well, we know how good Joe is. If he says it's right, we didn't challenge him. Then you go on to say, the morning of the New Zealand game, whatever happened, the coaches wanted to huddle and to go over some plays. I think there was a worry at that stage. We hadn't emphasised something enough. You go on to say the later point, too much detail, probably too much tension. Joe just needed to trust us. Stand by that?
Yeah, look, I think that it was misconstrued to say that I was blaming Joe. I think that, like, far from it. Like, for example, like, you know, I do have a book coming out, and like, it was written way before any of this stuff. Well, not way before, it was certainly written. And I think when it comes out and you actually read, you know, how the regard to which I hold Joe, I think that well, I don't know, but I don't think anyone holds him in a high regard. And like, I was simply saying that. And you need to remember that this was Joe's sort of last opportunity to make history. You know, he'd done so much history as Ireland coach.
Everyone's ribbed tightens a bit that year, I think.
Yeah, I think it did. And we wanted it so badly. And all I was really was commenting is in hindsight. And I think when you get somebody as detailed as Joe, whenever you say, look, we're going to step into space, and then you don't. And we did so after the England game, we kind of went, right, here we go. Here's the space to fill, and we did for the two Wales games in Scotland. And then I think, as a player, and obviously me as sort of captain, probably slipped back a little bit and got, right, we're comfortable, we're back into the groove that we were in 18. And then I wasn't as organised to fill it. And when you get somebody that wants something as bad as Joe and is so organised, and the great thing about him is he sees, I think, like, a good coach will will watch a video back and point it out to you. The great coaches will see things as they happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that he maybe saw an opportunity to go, right, well, look, the boys don't need this, so here I can, here's a little bit that I can fill in. And look, ultimately, I take responsibility for not filling that the way it should have been. And
because I was talking to a former player, and he was making the point that as controlling, if you want to use that word, as Joe is, and as detail orientated as he is, that he had experienced many games, big games, where in the early part of Joe's tenure, for instance, he would just simply not turn up to the captain's run and might have said on the quiet to Owen Redden, for instance, that was the name I heard, you do the captain's run today. This is your space. You take ownership of it. So clearly as a coach, he was aware of the benefits of that. And then that's why it's even maybe more confusing come 2019, somehow your involvement as well, your responsibility as well, between players and coach, that sort of, you reneged on that practice almost.
Yeah, I don't think we reneged on it. Like, I think what you don't come across in that text is I'm sitting with the benefit of hindsight,
yes,
looking for 1%. Like, I'm not saying under any circumstances did Joe go, right, I'm taking over everything. I'm talking about like little tiny moments where we should have been better. And like, that's ultimately, you know, when you're dealing with test rugby, like, that's what you're dealing with. You're dealing with 1%. And
so I wouldn't have thought a 5-10 minute huddle on the morning of a New Zealand game should be that detrimental. I mean,
no, I think it was just more me kind of saying that, you know, there's so much sort of tension and stress going around that you get little moments to relieve it. And look, I think that ultimately there are so many reasons that we didn't. And people are, I think the problem with this is that people want what happened, what happened, what happened, and you don't know. So really what you're doing is you're kind of going, in hindsight, I wonder if we did this, this and this, would have made a difference. Probably not, but I was just sort of saying, this is what I think. And look, to be honest, it hurt a little bit with some of the people that I think should know me and know me better. And like, I know that you had a couple of interviews, you had a panel on one of the rugby shows, you were interviewing Joe that night, and you know, I don't think that you necessarily missed me either. And I think certainly the people in the panel should know me better. Like, to say that I was trying to distance myself from it, like, I just don't like that, because that's not the way I am, and that's not what I do.
Yeah, I probably thought to a point, you know, I thought, look, there's two sides to it. There's the journalist, which wants every player to come home and give an hour-long interview on what went wrong. So if I separate that from a second, I thought, well, Jesus, captain of the team. Johnny Sexton, I think, came home and said he was pushed the Heineken Cup launch, and he said, you know, we're in-house, we're going to look after it, we'll figure out what happened. And so I thought, you know, captain to come out, maybe you should have just said, I'll put these points to Joe that I have. That was my point. I thought, geez, that kick a man when he's down.
Yeah, and I think that was the thing that probably annoyed me the most, was that it looked like it was kicking him down. Like, the difference with Johnny is that, you know, he was going back into a Leinster setup, he was doing, you know, whereas like, we were both out, and I probably felt like
freer.
Yeah, and look, it turned out that it was raw. You know, to a certain extent, I thought that I could give a bit of a hindsight opinion, and that's all it would be. You know, I didn't sort of think it would be taken as, I didn't think they would run with it as firmly. And obviously, I felt really bad that, like you say, and I did feel like it was kicking Joe when he was down, and that was never what I meant. And I think one of the frustrating things about it is that people want opinions. And I watched the England cricket documentary after the World Cup, after they won the World Cup. I don't know if you've seen it. And Owen Morgan is talking on it. And he's talking about 4 years previous when they bombed out in a team that they thought they should have at least been competing to get to the final. And he said that he went to the next World Cup and there were certain things that he was adamant he wasn't going to let happen, both as a player, but more importantly as a captain and a leader. Mm. And I think that that's one of the things that probably spilled over me, that it's so different from a Six Nations. It's so different from an Autumn International. Mm. And you don't, as a captain, get... I didn't even get the opportunity to play for Ireland again, to kind of go, I know that wasn't the best performance, but look what we can do. Mm. And certainly not as a captain. Like, there are so many things that I would do, well, potentially do different if I was to captain Ireland at a World Cup again.
So you wanted to put it out there.
And that's kind of what's put... Okay. And I know there's probably a better way to do it, but like, ultimately, I felt that
contribute to the IRFU review?
I filled in the form and stuff, and yeah, the problem was...
Is the form any good?
Well, you see, the thing was, I was away the Barbarian, so I was actually supposed to... There was a couple of follow-up meetings, but because I was away and I didn't get that chance, and, you know, it will be something that I would like to think in the future, that It won't go into the report, but I do think that they look.
It's in the ether.
Okay.
Two other quick things about what you said. I was very curious on you. And again, we're talking 1%ers here, so I don't want to take you out of context. But you detected almost what you said was almost an inevitable sense of slight complacency on the players' part. It's a big word. Big word.
It is a big word.
What little things were you seeing or sensing or feeling, and when in that year?
You know what? Again, it's the sort of hindsight, and you're looking back, and you go. I think one of the things you see is people training earlier in the week. And like, it's not to say that they're not injured, but I think whenever you're really trying to strive to somewhere, everyone's got a bit of a niggle, and people will go, do you know what, it's worth taking the risk with this niggle to train, mm-hmm. to prepare us. Whereas whenever you sort of go and you get into this rhythm where you feel like you can't lose, and that's where we were at in 18, like, let's be honest with it, like, even going into that New Zealand game, the thought of not winning wasn't even in our radar. On our radar. Mm. And I think then you start to get a little bit, and then things just become a little bit disjointed. And like, you know, it is such small margins.
Sure. Maybe you got a niggle on the Tuesday, you're like, we've got a World Cup in 6 months, I don't want to risk something silly.
Yeah, or maybe you get a bit of a niggle at the weekend and you could potentially train Tuesday, but you opt to train Thursday instead, and you know, that's a day's preparation. You know, just little bits like that. And again,
did you feel like you could call that out at the time?
Do you know what? Like, that's why it's hindsight, because if I'd have felt it at the time, I would have said it. Mm. And that's why it's frustrating, and that's why it's hard reading some of the stuff, because like, it's me looking back effectively going that these were errors that I made that I didn't see, and you kick yourself, you go, why didn't you see it? And if you had your go over, you'd know to look for it. And that's probably what my point about Owen Morgan was, you know, that he knew what the warning signs were. And look, ultimately, I probably could have been a bit more proactive. I should have been chatting a bit, you know, I like would chat to Draco and Polly a bit, but like, it's only now that I know that a World Cup's differently, you know. I should have sat down both of them and said, right, you have your time. And do you know what? You saw it with Draco from 07 to 11. Mm. You know, the difference in the whole squad harmony. And a lot of that was down to him. So he got it and he learned his lessons. And I really wish now that Ada went and picked up the phone and said, look, Draco, Paulie, you know, if you had the 15 World Cup or the 11 World Cup, which, you know, we should have won quarterfinals in, but didn't, you know, what would you do differently? Yeah. And look, I regret not doing that. And, you know, I thought it was enough that if everyone prepares themselves to play rugby to the best of their ability, that is enough. And probably as captain in a world tournament, it's not enough. You need to do a little bit more.
One last one on 19 and then a kind of final look back on the whole career. If we use it as a microcosm or as an example, if you take England at the Aviva Stadium at the 19 Six Nations, so a small thing, for instance, Conor Murray's box kicks have worked very well for a long time. Suddenly the escort lines turn into an absolute wall. You ain't getting through. So that's a very nice weapon that you had for several years that other teams have cottoned on to. It's taken them a year or two to practice and get to a point where they can stop it, and now they're stopping it. To use the broad term, Ireland, to some degree or other, a bit more worked out, a bit more focused on by opposition. Did you sense on the pitch at times, geez, this stuff that I've done for 2-3 years with this team and often paid dividends is now not paying dividends? Did that happen?
I don't think you ever really, you got a sense of that, because we did sort of change a little bit in that Six Nations, because we started to kick a bit more off 10 because we felt that it was just becoming ridiculous. And I think one of the frustrating things when you work with Joe, we put so much emphasis on discipline. You know, we talk about the detail, but discipline is so important to us. You know, we have such a low penalty count. And then you play other teams who just seem to do whatever they want, and then they don't get picked up, and you're kind of there going, like, you know, what is this all about? And that was a wee bit like those escort lines. Like, it was
technically an infringement, but
yeah. But they sort of let it, and then you're looking at it going, like, this isn't. But look, we obviously kicked a little bit more off 10, but I don't think you ever got the sense. I think there was always a belief. Now, what happened was England, look, the way they come out in that game, they come out like an express train, and we've done that to teams before, and it happened to us, and we were probably a wee bit shell-shocked. And
I guess it's more of a general point, like even in the World Cup, even against Japan, did
but,
you feel it?
But I'm sort of, my bigger point in that is that when that happened, so that was kind of like probably the moment in 19 for us that the pressure came on us.
Okay.
And then what happens when the pressure comes on, you get into your shell a little bit, because even we beat Scotland the next week, and we played within ourselves. We almost did enough to win. Mm. And instead of going out in 18 to go out and really take teams on when you're on top of the world and you feel you can do anything, we got a little bit tense because we felt the pressure. And We allowed the pressure to get to us.
It's funny, isn't it, when you beat New Zealand in November and Steve Hansen said, well, let's see how they like being everybody's target. I kind of dismissed it as casual enough chat, but potentially there's something in it. As a group, you weren't used to that.
Yeah, and we weren't. And like, again, I was the same. He sort of went, another sort of soundbite, whatever. And yeah, look, it whatever, in that England game, it just changed. You know, everything. And I think whenever you're on top, there is sometimes a bit of where people want to try to cut you down, and we sort of felt that pressure, that it was almost like this was the opportunity that people right across have been waiting for to go, I see, I told you Ireland weren't as good as I said they were. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of felt that, and it allowed you to go into yourself. And when you get in that kind of downward spiral, it's really hard to put your finger on what exactly it was. And
so it was crisis management territory.
It's a wee bit, yeah. And then what happens is you actually do fly in, when you don't need to fly into crisis. You know, look, at the end of the day, after the England game, we'd lost one game, and in fairness to Joe and Faz, like, they showed us so many examples where we actually should have had them, but we just let ourselves down a little bit. But what happened was then, I think we got under a bit of pressure, and we felt under pressure, and like we started to become a little bit uncharacteristic, you know, 18 especially, but even like leading right up to that had been about, you know, we keep the ball, we go through phases, we don't make mistakes, we don't give away penalties, and we started to lose the penalty count, because when you're trying to really, you know, right, I need to do something big here. What often happens is you make a mistake.
Sport is tricky, you know, and that's the other aspect here. So when you weigh up the longevity, your Ireland career here, the longevity and the highs and the captaincy and the Grand Slams and New Zealand and all the many things which probably surpassed expectations. I mean, it's not bad for Simon Best's younger brother. He did okay in the end. Versus the four World Cups. How do you walk away from your Irish career?
Look, I would have no regrets. You know, like, the stuff we're talking about now is, you'd love another opportunity at it, but that's not even regret. You just love another opportunity to try to do it differently. It's not to say...
Keep you awake at night?
No, not now. You know, you sort of... Like, I think when anyone mentions the World Cup, you get a bit of a feel in your stomach that you should have done, like, I think 11. We definitely were in a really good place.
That's a good team.
I think that we 100% underestimated Wales that day. Because we sort of, the way we played, and we had a lot of pressure to start and didn't quite get over the line. And then Mike Phillips scored that bit of a try. Sean O'Brien was held up over the line. You know, little things went against us.
The IRFU report said Japan were underestimated in 19.
You know, I am not. I think it looks on paper like they were, because, like, ultimately, we lost to what is supposed to be a tier two nation. So, like, that's the easiest thing to say, as though they were underestimated. In terms of our preparation and the footage that we were shown and everything around it, like, it was exactly the same as we would for any team. Mm-hmm. And I just think that we got, like, a 12-3, we had a couple of chances to go where we probably should have went to 19-3. And we, again, we give them back the ball too easily. And I think if we go to 19-3 again, we're... hindsight, but our, you know, ifs and buts. But
so, brief, you know, tangent, the Irish career then.
Sorry.
You walk away feeling contented, surpassed expectations quite probably.
I was a wee kid in Points Pass. If you had offered me four World Cups, 124 caps for Ireland, like, I would have taken one cap and one World Cup. And again, you get greedy. And for me to sit here and go, you know, the only regret I had is that I didn't play my last game in an Ireland jersey in a World Cup semi-final or final. You know, look, that's being selfish, and that's wanting to be the best you can be. But for me to play my last ever game captain Ireland at a World Cup, you know, was something that I can be proud of. And like, whenever the World Cup just finished, like for example, I remember going, coming home from that and bringing the kids into school and walking the youngest who just started to his classroom. And you know what, you almost had the head down, you almost felt embarrassed because you felt you'd let the country down. And it's actually only when you get out and about, the amount of people like, oh, you did us proud. And, you know, like that's the great thing about these supporters, is that they just want to see you trying your best. They don't expect you to win every time, but they want to see that. And we don't necessarily always get a full flavour of that.
The last question then. I presume you've been the butt of old man jokes for the last 6 or 7 years of your life on a daily basis, and now it flips and you suddenly emerge into the world as a young man, 37, with 30-odd years of work ahead of you. What are you going to do?
30 years of work? That sounds so bad. I think for the next little bit, you know, it's been 15 and a half years as a professional rugby player, and all the highs, lows, pressures, brilliant bits of it. I just want a bit of a break. Okay. You know, I'll do bits and pieces of commercial, of a few ambassador roles that I work with. That, like, ultimately the scariest thing is to pay the bills now, you know, especially now with a young family. So I'll get enough to make sure I can pay the bills. And what I want to do is try to work towards, firstly, getting back involved in rugby in some shape or form. I'm not even sure what that looks like yet. And also then to try to build some other interests. You know, like the way I was brought up was always, you know, you try to get as many opportunities as you can and you try to make the most of every one of them. And the great thing about the commercial stuff is that it allows me to hopefully make a difference, because, like, ultimately that's why I want to do it. I don't just want to be Rory Best on the side of a bit of packaging who takes the money. You know, I want to feel like you're making a difference somewhere. But also using that time to invest in my future, so that if somebody in 18 or 24 months says, right, Rory, no more commercial activity for you, that I actually have stuff that I want to do. The farming is going to form a part of that, but at the minute, I'm not doing any more farming than I did when I was playing, so it's going to form part of it. I'm doing a bit of stuff for the guy in Dublin. I have another guy in Belfast I'm chatting to. Like I say, rugby, I have so much to give back, that I want to give back to sport that give me so much. So I probably haven't given you much of an answer, well, because still, I'm not 100% sure, but there's a lot of things that I'm really interested in doing.
Maybe there's something to be said to not rush into anything. Rory Best, we wish you the very best of luck. Thank you.
Thank you.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.